This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hey there, Brandon Harvey here. Before we get started, I wanted to give a shout out to the sponsor of this week's episode, Who Gives a Crap? Okay, really quick, here's the story. So my wife and I have started the process of slowly replacing the normal things we regularly buy with brands and products that are ethically made, free of toxins, and make a difference in one way or another. We did this with our toothpaste, our household cleaners, and our bedding. But the thing that we're most excited about is our toilet paper. And I'm not kidding. That's where Who Gives a Crap comes in. Who Gives a Crap makes high-quality toilet paper that's 100% recycled or 100% bamboo so that you can quit wiping with trees. Their toilet paper is delivered straight to your house, which makes things so easy. And even better, they donate 50% of their profits to help build toilets for those in need. Who Gives a Crap is offering Sounds Good listeners $10 off their first order with the promo code SOUNDSGOOD. All one word, sounds good. Honestly, it's kind of a no-brainer. To get toilet paper delivered to your door, make a difference in the world, and to help support this podcast, just go to whogivesacrap.org/soundsgood and use the discount code SOUNDSGOOD. One more time, that is whogivesacrap.org/soundsgood with the discount code SOUNDSGOOD. Who Gives a Crap? Good for your bum and great for the world. All right, now here comes the show. What I admire most in an artist is the ability to be transparent about where you've come from. The singers and musicians who have made their humble beginnings and personal journeys accessible to others is an incredible gift that binds us together. My guest, R. Lamar, has done this so well, and I deeply admire him for that. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with his music, you are in for a treat. R&B singer and classical guitarist Reggie Williams Jr. never dreamed that his side musical project, R. Lamar, would blow up, but it did in a huge and surprising way. At the release of his 2016 single, Frustrated, racking up over 37 million streams on Spotify to date, his music has become instantly recognizable and familiar to countless people. From his humble beginnings in Bradenton, Florida, to currently playing at major festivals like Bonnaroo and Lollapalooza, R. Lamar's hope has always been to give back to music what he believes it gave to him, which was a place of refuge, belonging, and release ever since his complicated youth. It's also notable to mention that his music has been featured and praised by major media outlets like Billboard and Rolling Stone. I am Brandon Harvey, and this is Sounds Good, the weekly podcast where we have conversations with inspiring people who are rejecting cynicism and using their lives to make an impact. And before we get started, I need to warn y'all because R. Lamar basically just started speaking brilliance as soon as I hit the record button while I was still giving him some context on what the show is about. And so we just decided to start the podcast in the middle of kind of my little intro to him. So I love it so much. He's a musical genius with a heart and a story, and I hope it leaves you in feeling inspired and less alone. Okay, here's the conversation. We fully believe that, you know, we connect more with each other's scars than each other's successes.
Yeah.
With, you know, the journeys that got us to where we are than actually where we are.
Yeah.
And so
I think the scars can help contextualize the success.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Because it's, I love seeing people who are successful, and I love when people are creative, like their craft is so good.
Yeah.
But it sometimes can feel meaningless if there's not a story behind it.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that. I definitely relate to people who have had similar happenings and similar paths and whatnot to mine, who I see doing things that I deem as, you know, positive or productive mm-hmm. or something I might want to emulate.
Yeah.
And that is why I think it's important to continue telling those stories
yeah.
so that you can kind of facilitate that same effect in somebody yeah. else, hopefully through whatever.
I feel like you're sharing the heat and we're not even started yet.
Uh-huh.
You can't be like okay. dishing all this out. You got to say all that again.
I didn't know we were started. I mean, you hit the record button. I thought we were going. I don't know.
We can just start now. I like this. This is a great way to start off.
Yeah, I'm always on.
Yeah, it's really interesting because it's not an easy thing to yeah. talk about. You know, the scars behind your successes is yeah, way hard. Easier to brag. Oh my gosh. It's so easy to say, check out this cool thing I did. And it's so hard to say, here's the thing that sucked. Even if the thing yeah. wasn't your fault.
Yeah.
It's either a sense of shame or a sense of guilt or a sense of
yeah.
something that keeps you from sharing that. But it's,
yeah.
I find that it's valuable, like you said, and helpful for other people.
There's a lot of things, I mean, that can get in the way of sharing certain parts of the truth of a matter. I think just growing up, I just was like, oh, well, like, you know, growing up where I did, everybody went through similar things.
Where did you grow up?
In Bradenton in Florida.
Okay.
You know.
What were those things?
Just, you know, like, when I was in middle school, kids were, like, wild dealing. And
really?
Like, gangs and, like, all that craziness. I was chubby and too scared of all of that. You know what I'm saying? I just wanted to play with my Yu-Gi-Oh cards and be left alone. You know what I'm saying? But, I mean, you just end up getting involved in things that are just bad for
yeah.
you know, bad for the environment that you're in. But all your friends are also kind of sucked into that environment, too, just because we live there, you know. So it sort of becomes a sense, there's like a sense of normalcy to all that. Like,
yeah,
you know, homeboy got shot last week, like, all right, I mean, that's just what happens here. You know what I'm saying?
Totally.
And that's an interesting thing because I've talked to other people about this sort of thing, and they think, like, oh, you're not from, like, where people generally think of as, like, a violent area.
No. When I hear Florida at the end of something, I just kind of think, like, oh, you were surrounded yeah. by old people.
Tourists, which is also true. Whole state. It's just, like, colleges and college kids and, like, retirees. But there's also that stuff. So, and it was just like a strange income disparity because the neighboring, the sister city, is Sarasota.
Got it.
Sarasota is a place that a lot of people have heard of because it has like Venice Beach down near it and Maria Island. A lot of affluence down there. And then the neighboring city, Bradenton, where I came up, was a lot like poorer. And you know what I'm saying? The people that couldn't afford to live in Sarasota.
Yeah.
Yeah, all these kind of wild things just happen in the streets, and like you just get exposed to all this stuff, and you begin to believe, like, oh, that's normal life. You know, that's
yeah.
how it is for everybody until you start to see the affluence just across the bridge. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you almost,
so it's weird.
You see that context, and all of a sudden you're like, oh, crap, like there's a disparity here. There's a difference.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that I think is a big problem for people who never experience any sort of that in their life, who live their entire lives in, you know, the Sarasotas of the world, and they
yeah.
never head over to the sister city, because it would be so easy to judge somebody by being like, oh my gosh, I can't believe they did this or this or this, or they
yeah.
were in that environment. But the reality is they could be the best person in that town.
Yeah.
Their context is rough. Their context that they
yeah.
were raised in is difficult.
Yeah. And there's a lot of things you got to do when you're just trying to raise a family, you know what I'm saying? And
mm-hmm.
the odds are against you. And on the flip side, like, I know those cats from Sarasota, and I grew up with all them, the kids that are really, really affluent, really, really rich. And from the outside in, it looks like they have everything, you know what I'm saying? But that can be a sense of isolation and loneliness and stuff, because you can't relate to people, you know what I'm saying? Like,
oh, yeah.
Frank Ocean has a really great song called Super Rich Kids, and if you're
yep,
a Frank Ocean
yep.
fan. Today's actually anniversary of the 6-year anniversary of the release of Channel Orange, if you couldn't tell that I'm a fan. It's July 10th. That record was released July 10th, 2012. Anyway.
That's amazing.
But, yeah, he's got a great song called Super Rich Kids about it. And it's just about how, like, that affluence and the perception that you have everything can be this thing that is isolating and makes you feel wrong for not feeling completely, like, elated all the time about having whatever people consider, whatever society considers to be wealth and affluence and like blah, blah, blah. Because, I mean, we definitely have a big problem. I think I've said this on Twitter before, and it's definitely in my drafts, if not.
But we've all got drafts that are...
yeah, that are just fire tweets, and I haven't gotten them off yet. But it just, I mean, particularly in America, and I mean, this is definitely a place where there's... this is definitely always present in places where there's a lot of wealth disparity.
Mm-hmm.
But we have this idea that being that richness is righteousness, that being wealthy is being equals being a good person.
Yeah.
And like, or that, or from other people, like if you're wealthy, then you can't be a good person. You know what I'm saying? Because you've never had to struggle.
Yeah,
and I say that in never had to struggle in air quotes. Like
there's a lot of morality tied to money on both ends of the spectrum.
Totally.
It really has nothing to – it's correlation, not causation.
Yep, association is not causation. Shout out to the economics rule. Let's go.
Oh, shout out to my middle school and high school teachers.
In another life.
And then all the podcasts that kept me thinking about that ever since.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's really funny. I'm definitely a big old nerd that listens to like finance podcasts.
Yeah, me too, me too. So growing up, though, you stayed mostly out of trouble, partly because you were chubby. But like, who else was kind of influencing you in your life then? What was your family like?
My parents divorced when I was five. So
okay.
It's been very different. I had a talk with a couple of friends of mine just to hang out recently. My friend, Ellery, who goes by Ezza, she's another artist.
Great.
And she's very cool. And so this other guy, Dylan Southwell, goes by Trove. And another friend of mine, Jeff, who is a singer-songwriter as well. They all had very, like, kind of typical Southern Christian upbringing.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying? Like, a lot of people did. And I didn't. Like, I just wasn't involved in the church or anything like that. My family wasn't involved. Really, I did start singing in the church when I was nine because my grandmother was involved at like the Methodist church that she'd gone to for her whole life.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
And it's weird when you moved to Nashville and you weren't Nashville is, there's this study that said that Nashville is the most churched city in the entire country.
Yeah.
So there's more people who go to church than anywhere else.
And there's more church, I believe there's more churches per like capita.
I believe it. When I go on a jog in the morning, I go past like 12.
At least 10.
And yeah. I can't run that far.
In a mile. So that really sort of informs, you know, for better or for worse, that informs a lot of people's opinions about the world and a lot of people's like upbringing and stuff. And,
mm-hmm.
and for me, I was just like missing all of that. So it's interesting. This is the talk that I was just referencing was that we're talking about how much that forms a lot of people's worldview. And for me, I just kind of didn't have that. And so they're really curious, I guess, about worldviews in context of certain things. Because there's definitely a lot of like, you know, there's supposedly the separation from church and state, but there's definitely a lot of like Christian dogma and doctrine in just absorbed into U.S. into
very
our society,
much a part of the culture.
Super, super part of a culture. So I definitely was exposed to those things, but never like going to church until I moved in with my father. Remarried when we were like 14, and when I was 14, and then moved in with him and my stepmother at the time, who was like adamant church goer. I was there like 6 times a week, maybe 5, but. Yeah, parents divorced when I was very young. I was the only boy, so that was kind of difficult as well.
How many sisters did you have?
2 older sisters.
Okay.
I'm the youngest. And so it was me and my 2 sisters and my mother. And apparently for a time when I was really, really young, me and my sister Ariana, we were very close. But the older sister, Tatiana, it was like 8 years older than me.
Got it.
She's still alive. She is 8 years older than me. And it's like, you know, when I was in second grade, she was in high school, so she like wasn't trying to hang out with me.
Totally.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that was just a natural divide there, but it was strange because, you know, my father had sort of always been created to me as being this like sort of antagonistic figure, and I was just like him, so it became this weird like bad, like, you remind me of this thing that we're supposed to dislike, you know, categorically. You know, that I think that ended up creating a lot of like insecurity, especially like male insecurity, and like and then you swing hard the other way with like toxic masculinity things that at the time I didn't know that's what it was.
Nobody did really.
It's things that were shout out to wokeness in the last like 5 years.
I know.
But yeah, there was a lot of that stuff. Had a lot of like anger issues and stuff when I was a kid. Some therapy from when I was like kindergarten-ish all the way through grade school. Just because I was like, you know, getting fights and like just wild things or whatever. But simultaneously, I think I was in first or second grade, and a teacher, they had me take a gifted test, right?
Oh, okay.
And it's this thing, it's just like, just aptitude or whatever. Yeah. And if you show, you know, for those of you who are listening who may not know, if you show a higher aptitude, then they put you in these advanced courses as a wee little youngin. And I did really well in those tests and whatnot, and was taken and would be bused like 2 or 3 times a week all throughout up to high school to a separate school where they like kept in all the gifted kids.
Oh, wow.
And then, but at the same time, I was told I have these like anger management issues and need to be fixed. And like, I was stuttering really bad and like couldn't pronounce things well. And so the like weird simultaneous life, I guess, the weird kind of dichotomy was like people are telling you your brain is exceptional, but also that your brain doesn't work correctly.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? So I think that like created this weird and difficult like confidence.
It's like too nuanced divide for you to understand as a kid.
Yeah,
it's like you're totally good and bad is almost what
exactly
you're hearing.
And that's how you react to it as a kid. It was strange, and it's definitely been a process of figuring out systems, I guess, for myself. I guess that's kind of the way my brain works.
Yeah.
But making things understandable and like operable for me.
Yeah. Yeah, because you didn't have that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like you didn't have that family structure.
I didn't have
you
a traditional family structure. No.
You didn't have that faith structure.
Totally, no.
You didn't have, I mean, I guess it sounds like you got moved to essentially a better school structure.
Mm. Well, we were busing back and forth. I'd still be in the regular school, and then some days out of the week, they'd take us over to the gifted
course. So that's kind of funny.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting that now you're saying, okay, how can I create this structure because I didn't have it earlier.
Yeah, that's a pretty astute read of that, I suppose. Growing up, that was that. You know, a bunch, couple divorces. We moved a whole bunch. Father remarried a couple times. What were you going to say?
Were you doing music at all early on?
Not at the time,
okay.
No. I mean, not creating any music, I think. I mean, I was definitely close to music because I remember earlier on in life my mother playing like Sade and Anita Baker and like all that kind of stuff way early. It's funny, I think I put up a tweet yesterday where I was like, I got home, we just got back from this Louis the Child in Big Wild tour, which was really, really cool, called Camp Nowhere Texas, and we just got back, and you know, you get back off tour. I don't know if you've been in bands and stuff. You've
I have
band
not. I,
oh, people, really? Where?
I was. Let me tell you.
Okay,
earlier today, I was singing one of your songs, just like around the house,
because
I knew I was
Thanks.
Like, yeah. Well, it gets worse. And my wife goes, "What are you doing?
Whose man's is this?"
And she's like, and I was like, "I'm singing." First of all, she's like, "What are you singing?" And I'm like, "Oh, it's Arlo Martin." And she's like, I know what that song sounds like. This is not anything like that.
But what you're doing, not the one, my guy. Not
yeah,
the one.
So I have never
wow,
been
shout
in
out
a
to
band.
The wife, keeping your feet on the ground.
I need it so bad.
Nah, bro. That ain't it, bro.
Anyway, so
but yeah,
I don't just know the life, but you just got back from tour.
Getting back, for me, the next day for me is usually filled with like errands and like, you know, like returning maybe rented equipment or like cleaning the car because the band doesn't clean the car and, you know, gassing up and like doing stuff like that. And I got home and my room is usually a mess because I have a pretty small room and I have to move a bunch of stuff around to get to the car. And that next day getting off tour is usually doing those errands, and one of them is cleaning the house. So I'm like cleaning the house. I've got like sandalwood incense burning. Anita Baker is on the background and I'm like, oh my God, I'm my mother. Oh my God.
That's amazing.
What have I done? But so that stuff really takes me back to my my young youth. And being like 9 and 10-ish, I was got into the choir a little bit because my mother wanted me to do it.
Yeah.
I hated it at the time, but I kind of regret that. I wish I had stuck with it, but, you know, I am who I am.
You've got like a great voice.
Thank you.
When you were a kid, did
you
have
so
that
kind.
Same...
Wow.
What can I say?
Come on this podcast every week.
Yeah, please do. You're welcome back. Did you kind of notice your talent then, or was that something that you had to find later?
I don't think it's a thing where, at least in my recollection of growing up, memory can be fallible, but in fact, it's proven to be quite fallible, but at least...
We should have a whole conversation about these things that are just like memory and economics, yeah, because this is speaking my language, all this like...
You wanna lose some followers, I'll bore them. I'll bore
you
them
and I
right
can basically
till they
have
skip
like
to
a Netflix
episode.
Crime show with all this
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, let's get it. I think I'm kidding. But yeah, I think growing up, really, I don't think I really perceived of it as like a talent, because no one tells you growing up that like, okay, you have permission to be talented. You can be talented.
Yeah.
It's just like, this is a thing you do. And if you're doing it, great. And if people like it, great, whatever. But if people don't, whatever. You do the next thing. So I would get like solos and like they'd ask me to sing the lead part or whatever. But that was just kind of like, okay, you're just sort of playing this position in this kind of group effort of being in a choir. You know what I'm saying? I don't think I ever really thought of it was like, whoa, I'm talented or amazing. Blah, blah. I guess I just never, like, growing up, this was an important realization, I think, in college. But growing up, I never really saw a ton of people, specifically people like me, brown people, brown men specifically, who were doing the things that I thought that I was either good at or wanted to continue doing. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, like, for music, for me, the stuff I was listening to was like old soul and R&B and the stuff that my mother would let us listen to. Mm-hmm. But then I got to middle school and started listening to like Linkin Park and like bands and wanting to be in the Mars Volta so bad.
That's
you know?
So funny.
But I didn't see any dudes do anything like that, with the exception of like Thomas Pridgen, who was the drummer for the Mars Volta, or like Howard from Killswitch Engage, or like... I can't even think of anything else off top.
It's a short list. So
for in my recollection at the time, it was a short list.
Because you weren't looking, you basically had the R&B, mm-hmm. you're looking at bands, you weren't looking at rap.
Yeah, I didn't think I was a rapper. Well, no, I mean, we enjoyed rap. My sister had a big thing. It was a weird thing in my household because my sister, Tupac was a big deal in my household, all right? Because my older sister, Tatiana, she was out. She was like listening to that stuff when like Ambitious as a Riders and stuff like that was out. And, you know, you hear all the wild stuff like California Love and, you know what I'm saying, I Get Around and like all that stuff. And my mother hears that stuff and she's like, all of this is garbage. She never heard like Brenda Got a Baby, Dear Mama, that song that's like Changes, like that stuff, the beautiful like poetry that that Tupac had. But anyway, again, way off topic. But no, it's on topic. It's music.
Yeah.
But that's just kind of part of the hodgepodge and the mosaic of whatever I was listening to at the time. At the time, I just didn't – whatever happened, I didn't understand that those people got there through, like, obviously talent, but, like, work ethic and hard work and dedication
yeah.
is also a big, big part of it. And I didn't understand. I just thought you were just, like, you know, you were just – the John Mayers of the world, and those people, they're just born with this thing. And we are plebeians who are set to receive their manna. You know what I'm saying? And we are never allowed to cross that threshold.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize that John Mayer went to school for a bunch and like practiced like 13 hours a day and like all that stuff.
Yeah,
so I discovered that later on.
Because you don't see the path that they take.
Yes,
so you
the
assume
music
that
industry
they're...
is very good at that. They're very good at making things look like they came out of nowhere.
Yeah. I mean,
very,
even
very
like Justin Bieber has one of the most public like stories of his rise. But the reality is like even before he got discovered, like he was playing like 7 instruments before.
There was something that got him to that point of discovery. Absolutely.
It's fascinating. And yeah, nobody is an overnight success.
Yeah. It's interesting. 2 Chainz says it took me 10 years to become an overnight success. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, it's that Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours rule you know, putting in that time, putting in that energy. Mm-hmm. And that takes 10,000 hours is so long.
It's a lot.
I don't know if I've done 10,000 hours of anything except for eating, breathing, and
except for being alive.
Yeah.
And even then, there's a difference between just doing something for 10,000 hours and doing it well for 10,000
hours.
You know what I'm saying? But yeah, that was part of that musical journey. I didn't get a guitar until I was in high school. And my guitar teacher at the time, shout out to teachers who are really, really underrated in the society, mm-hmm. but his name was Doug Seff. He was a guitar teacher at Manchester School for the Arts. And I guess he noticed that I had like an acumen for guitar, or at least classical guitar at the time, which was what I was studying. And he was like, you need to get a guitar to practice at home, because your music teachers can tell, like, look, dude, you're not practicing. It's just like any other teacher that's like, you winged this and did not study. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You like can get through it, but that's just a bad way to live your life. Like,
totally.
But so he was like, you got to get a guitar. And I ended up getting a job. I was 14, I believe, getting a job as a busboy at this place called Blue Water Grill and Tavern, and saved up a little bit of money, bought a Yamaha CG-101 for $212, and got my thing, got it, started getting it going. And simultaneously at the time, I was in high school, a bunch of girls didn't like me, had all these feelings I couldn't express, so I just started writing sappy songs about it.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's how it starts.
I think one of the best things about people who aren't cool in high school is that they end up being the people who are cool after high school.
I hope so. There's got to be some correlation, because I've talked to some of my other buddies from, it was an art school, it was a charter school.
Okay.
And we did, like, you had to do one of each of the arts, and that's how I got into music.
Got it.
Was I was forced to take a piece of some sort of music, and yeah, I chose guitar because that was what I saw bands playing. Again, my whole journey has been completely serendipitous. So many touch points of like right place, right time.
Yeah.
But that is one of them. I also had to do drawing, had to do theater, a theater art, and then like a physical art, which I took Taekwondo because my school did that, which was tight.
That's actually amazing.
Yeah. But I just know some people, like a friend of mine, Caitlin Burns, who is an artist. Visual artist. She does like lenticular images and GIFs and stuff for like Bonnaroo and like all these cool brands.
Awesome.
And my friend Justin Oakesford, who animates for Halo and Bungie. And my other friend, Andrew Theophilopoulos, who has the most Greek name ever, but also animates stuff for like Warcraft and blah, blah, blah. We were not the popular. We were not the kids.
That's amazing.
Like, we were not the first pick for, you know, none of us had like were like the senior quotables or anything like that, you know what I'm saying? But we ended up sticking with it. And a lot of those cats who are like doing dentistry or doing other things, not to, you know, disparage those.
Yeah, but, I mean, we all need dentists.
Yeah, absolutely. Not to disparage those other careers, but they're just doing other things. But it's just interesting that at the time that everybody betted on, would have bet on them to continue and have careers.
Yeah.
In the arts fields, you know, that doesn't make anybody better than or worse than, but it's just an interesting correlation.
It's also got to help that that your heart was getting broken again and again, and you got to write love songs that were like from a place of heartbreak rather than like, everybody loves me. See, I'm not going to sing.
Everything is great, but... and I'm nice, and everybody loves me. Yeah, I'm so well adjusted and never had problems in my life. Yeah.
I'd scream that on Spotify. I'm going to upload that.
You're like,
right
oh,
now.
Wow, great. This is
bonus track.
Boring.
Yeah, okay, so that's so interesting. Mm. You start playing guitar.
Yes.
You come out of high school. Mm-hmm. What happens right out of high school?
Out of high school, I went back to Bradenton, and it was MCC at the time, Manatee Community College, and went back there and started doing more music stuff because, you know, back in Florida, I don't know if y'all know this, but in Florida, you can do the 2-in-2 thing where you go to a community college for 2 years and is an automatic acceptance into a 4-year university.
A lot of people stick around in Florida because of that.
Yeah, so went home.
You know, they're trying to keep people around and instead of just old people.
Keeping young folks, yeah. Went home, did that, was writing songs and still doing the thing. I was definitely simultaneously throughout college, just zipping forward to college because I want to, you know, get through my backstory as quick as possible so we can talk about like stuff we're doing now and like, you know, our thoughts and emotions and whatnot. But simultaneously throughout high school, I was studying music in school, but I was also writing on the side and like playing music and touring. And because my manager, Chris Martinago, now has been a good friend of mine since we were both like 16.
Oh, really? That's
cool. We've known each other for like over 10 years, and he was in bands. And the cool thing about only being able to afford an acoustic at the time was that it was easy for me to open for them for those bands because they would have like a whole SUV or blah, blah, blah. I could just hop in with my backpack and my guitar. So I did that like a bunch for a bunch of bands.
And you were doing
in Florida.
So you were doing acoustic,
uh-huh,
guitar.
I call it my
and
best
voice.
Like, yes, I call it my best John Mayer impression, basically.
That's amazing.
But y'all can just search Reggie Williams music, and that stuff all still comes up. All those those pieces of music are still, because they're just all still parts of me. You know what I'm saying? So they're all there. I didn't like delete them or anything.
So when did the kind of transition begin towards, well, first of all, where did the name R. Lamar come from?
R. Lamar is just my name. It's just Reginald Lamar. That's my, Lamar's my middle name.
Oh, there we go. I was going to ask if,
yeah,
I was going to ask if people ever just call you like Mr. Lamar.
Sometimes. And sometimes interviewers will call me R. I'm like, oh.
They're like, you didn't check my Wikipedia page.
Like a single thing? Yeah, no, that's cool. But it's interesting to see how people interpret it. This is a story for another day, I think. But yeah, the name is like a timeline for me. All that information is readily abundant on the internet, though. So yeah, the kind of transition to R. Lamar was, R. Lamar, interestingly enough, just started as a side project.
Okay.
I was in college at the time, and we were studying commercial music. Commercial music, for those of you who may not know, is like, at least at FSU, was studying things, programs like Ableton and Cubase and Pro Tools and recording and music software and all that stuff in production. And so we were just making beats and doing that stuff for projects for school.
With the emphasis on it being digital instead of bringing in a bunch of bands.
Yeah, and also, yeah, and I mean, and the overlap and doing both.
Got it. Because,
like, even in R. Lamar stuff, I still play guitar. I still, you know, there's live drums and whatnot. So I got involved with a studio at the time, Ethnic Kids, and they helped me produce some of the first four tracks that I was going to put out as R. Lamar, because I was just going to put it on SoundCloud, have it be like a side project, whatever, and keep doing the Reggie Williams music thing as well. Just because, you know, you get, as a person who makes things, you get interested in a lot of things and want to try a lot of things, and I just wanted to try it.
Yeah, and it's smart to try it under another name,
a moniker,
too.
Yeah. Also, just to keep things separated, you know, keep them, but now that Offspring song is playing in my head. But that happened. But the first song we put out, Show Me, got picked up by Spotify when it was New Music Tuesday, which was like a couple years back.
Yeah.
And that was a big, like, and we started getting like label offers and all this business stuff. Like, hey, can you come play the school night in LA? Can you come do the mom and pop showcase? And can you come to Europe? Can you like do this? And I was like, I don't even have a band. I didn't even think anybody was going to respond that quickly.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Or at all, you know,
but how
it was just
it
like
feel?
A labor of love. It was dope. Like, it was amazing, but it was confusing.
Yeah.
It was definitely like, Oh, I can go play this live. Oh, how am I going to do that? you know, it definitely presented a lot of like, oh, wow, we got a lot of holes in this game. You know what I mean? Like, we got to figure that out. But it was definitely validating to be like, oh, cool. People, like, dig this, you know? People, like, really want to help bolster this thing involved. So continue putting out music, and here I am today. Yeah.
That's amazing, man. I'm glad you do. I mean, I'm
giving the SparkNotes version, but
this
great.
Because
all
of
that, the whole story is just, when we do podcasts, when we do something unique with you, that whole story is all out there. You know what I'm saying? Y'all can Google me.
Honestly, you know? That was bad. I mean, I feel like I have Googled you, and I felt like a lot of that was still fresh. It was really interesting.
All right, word. All right, word.
I'm so glad we got some of that backstory.
Yes.
You know, bringing it up to speed. I saw you at Bonnaroo a few weeks ago.
Word.
And I wasn't even planning on going
Which
to Bonnaroo, but I just ended up there, and
word.
I think your set was the first or second I saw.
Word.
Dude, it was amazing.
Thank
it was so
you,
good.
Man.
Like,
you I have
you
a vlog
can
about that.
It so well. And
thank you. Thanks. That was wild. That was amazing. Because, you know, you just grow up, at least as a musician, you grow up seeing festivals, and it's presented to you as like, it's this Valhalla, it's this thing, you know. And then you actually get to go. I mean, there's ups and downs to it, because it's usually like mad hot and like very disorganized, but.
Yep.
At least in my experience, a lot of them have been. But as we're playing these like cooler and like nicer festivals like Bonnaroo, it's like you get there and just like everything goes where it needs to be. And like you're in a dressing room and like they fill your rider. What? You're going to bring me food just for playing? What? You know, and the stage was big and beautiful. And like what
and
I said on stage.
The crowd was big. Yeah.
Crowd was wild.
Crowd was wild.
But what I said on stage was like 2 years ago, I was in that crowd at that tent watching Miguel play. And at this tent as well. I played at that tent.
Which is I hate the names
of
their
annoying.
Tents.
It's annoying.
This tent,
yeah, it's
that
dumb.
Tent,
which
stage,
tent, who
what's,
tent, where. Yeah,
oh
it's
my
dumb.
Gosh.
It's not cute.
It's
not
it's
cute.
Like cute for a minute, and then you're like, oh, I'm confused.
It's 15 or so years ago. I think it's like the 15th or 16th anniversary of Bonnaroo.
No.
And like 15 or 16 years ago, when like whatever hippies that put this festival on were like, oh, that's going to slay. You know what I'm saying? And it just became like a tradition. It's like, guys, tradition is not good sometimes. But
anyway, you're on stage.
Yes. on stage, and I was saying that 2 years ago I was at that specific stage watching Miguel play.
Man.
And just wishing, like, man, I wish I could be there. Like, I want to do that. You know, I feel like I could do that. Just give me a shot. And then the shot came, and we ended up headlining that day, basically. So,
that's beautiful.
And yeah.
Where does that drive come from for you? Like, what's the thing that... Because your yeah. goal isn't really like, I want to just stand on stage.
Yes. You know, I want to play Bonnaroo and then I quit.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
You're like, no, seriously, it is.
For me, yeah, I'm already retired.
I'm unemployed.
But for me, it's like, I would like to say, and I've said this a bunch of times to Chris, who's known me forever, I just want to give back to music what it gave to me. You know, I didn't have a ton of friends growing up. I spent, and also just my family and sisters and mother, where the way we like grew up at home, we were just very quiet. We just stayed in our rooms all day, you know, and I'd just be like reading or like, so I just wasn't very socialized, I think. And I'm still like kind of learning that, like, I need to go and like hang out with my friends and like talk to them and stuff like that. When in my brain, it's like, if I haven't told you I don't like you, then I like you and we're friends. Like,
exactly.
It's not a big deal.
Well, I'm the same way.
But, you know, you got to like be there for people and meet them where they and try to be empathetic and understand that other people, you know, are going through things. And but for me, music was, I felt like, the first place I found like a true refuge. I know that's like cliche, but things are cliche for a reason, because they continue to prove that they have an element of truth, I think. And seriously, like, that was such a big deal for me, discovering music. And also another thing was the music that I liked at the time, it just wasn't cool for, I guess, maybe me to like, because Stained was like my favorite band. It's been a while. Like, but just that song, Warm Safe Place, off of Break the Cycle, I remember the first time I heard vocal harmony and being like, yo, that is dope. That is so sick. And even though I was in choirs and all that stuff, for some reason it didn't ring with me until I heard it there.
Yeah.
Just how plaintively he sings and just the things he sings about and whatnot, I was just like, this guy gets me, you know. And then Circus Survive came, was a big deal for me. Paramore was a huge deal for me. Coheed and Cambria was a big deal for me. So just these guys and women and bands and artists creating these things that became a refuge for me. I was lucky enough to continue to have like started playing when I was young and just like trying to emulate them. And then a friend of mine, Erica Dorson, was like, you need to play a show, because these songs you're writing and whatnot, we like them and we think they can do things for people. So played my first show and just kept getting asked. You know, that's going to sound wild cocky, but it's true, is that people just kept asking me to continue playing shows. I never booked any shows for myself for like years, because kids just kept asking me to play. And I guess there was something that they felt or saw or whatever from what I was doing. So I kept doing it and kept doing it. And then you realize at a certain point that it's bigger than you. These kids, like, these people, kids is diminutive, but it's like it's definitely like a thing that I just said from the Warped Tour scene, I guess. But you know what I mean? But just these people, these humans, these like individuals at whatever stage in their life might need something that you have to say. You know what I'm saying? So it's a responsibility to become. What do you think it is that I have to say that they may need, is you asking?
Yeah. I don't know if that's a weird thing for you to answer, but.
No, it's not. I mean, but I don't think it's up to me to determine.
Yeah.
Specifically what each individual is going to need. I think it's up to me to understand that there's a responsibility in the position that I'm in. Mm. And even though I'm not like a, you know, I'm not Dua Lipa or something. I'm not like taking over the super world, but
she
like
was
there
great
are
at the
people.
Show too.
Yeah. There was people, but just saying, like, there are people that are listening at this point and are very tied to it in the same, possibly in the same ways that I was tied to the things that I was really tied to. And just trying to put myself in that position, you have to understand that it is a responsibility, and you have to do your best to be like truthful and honest, and something that, regardless of how dark it may be or how like straight up like it's just power pop light on the other side, it can be, you just got to be honest about that thing, so that when you're up there performing it, you're not lying, you know.
Oh,
and I think
good.
that might be a thing that you may have connected with when we were at the Bonnaroo show.
Yeah.
It was just like I was pumped and smiling and tripping and like having an amazing time, not like tripping on acid or anything, but like just tripping because I was like, yo, this is wild.
Yeah,
you know,
you were feeling it.
I was feeling myself, honestly, because it's just like, who would have thought a kid like me from Braintree could come do this, you know?
Yeah.
What I'm saying, through whatever serendipitous wild amount of events,
because you're just telling the truth.
I'm here, I'm telling my truth, and I guess people are connecting with that. And it is also part of my truth that I believe that, like, you gotta try to kind of pay it forward and say those things. Like, you guys could one day do this too. And hopefully, like, the Nashville Scene actually had a write-up about it, and they said, like, hopefully, don't be surprised if in 2 years or something like that, you see some kid and he's on stage and he was like, I saw Arla Maar, and that inspired me to get up there and do my thing, which would be the ultimate treat for me, you know?
I just got goosebumps.
That would be wild, right?
Yeah.
I'd probably cry, B, straight up. Like, but so I think one thing that definitely keeps me going, one is knowing that it's bigger than me. Two is understanding that, for me, I think empathy is a really, really important and, like, under-taught thing in our society, really. And I would hope that I'm writing from a position that is, like, not only trying to express my opinions and express the things that I'm saying, but trying to create situations where you can, you, the listener, the royal you know what I mean, can feel like I have been there, or I feel this, or, like, somebody else understands me in the way that Stained or My Chemical Romance or Thrice or Circus Survive or whatever understood me. You know what I'm saying? So I'm just trying to complete the cycle. I'm just trying to be a part of the continuum and do my part so that the next generation can go do their part. Not like I'm like 80, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm on my, like, Elton John's going on his last tour, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm on my last tour or something, but I've still got plenty of music in me and plenty of tour and plenty of stuff to continue doing, but I definitely don't think it's lost on me the responsibility that, you know, this position gives you.
Yeah, man. Do you feel like there's something in particular that inspired, I guess maybe even a better question is there someone in particular that inspired that responsibility? You know, that you learned that from example, because, I mean, you totally could have learned it on your own, but I think I had somebody teach me that. Like, I had somebody literally sit down and be like, this is what you do when you have a talent. You use it to give back. You use it to pay it forward. You use it to come full circle.
Yeah. I'm hard-headed, so. but again, serendipitously, I'm lucky to have a lot of teachers in my life, literal teachers and other people who just end up teaching you things, who showed me sort of certain ways of living. And again, everybody's growing, everybody's changing, everybody's trying to get more woke with every day, you know what I'm saying? But I'm hard-headed. Sometimes I got to be taught a couple times. I know that about myself. But I had a teacher, a Taekwondo teacher, and he was very, very good to us and really, really like a strong figure in my life. Unfortunately, he passed away. But I remember in his class, and I was, I guess I had an acumen for Taekwondo. I had a physical kind of thing. And I would be able to, you know, spar and do well with the kids that were higher levels of me and whatnot. And I do remember one time, again, this was simultaneously with all the, like, anger issues and stuff I had growing up. And you give this kid this, like, power and this, like, oh, you're, like, good at this thing. And it's, like, potentially physically harming other people. So there's this kid and another kid, and I'll leave names out, but this kid, and he ran up on me in the lunchroom, and I ran up on him, and I kicked him really super hard, and he, like, fell over and, like, really hurt himself, and I'm not proud of it, but it is the truth, it is what I did, and he ran up on me, and I, like, did that to him, and since I found out, took me aside, and he was like, you have an ability, and you have a strength and a certain thing. And what you need to understand is that any ability can be as destructive as it is positive. You can use that for good and for as like much of a superhero wind up as this sounds like, but it's true. You can use this as for positive things as if you just see it that way and understand and be like kind of sober about the idea that like this could be a destructive impulse and those destructive impulses that you have. And he was also like, if you ever do anything like that again, I'll never teach you again. But I also had a guitar teacher, Doug Seth, who was like, no, you're good at this. And he was like one of the first people to be like, you're good at this. Like, zoom out and think about it and really take it seriously, because if you want to do it, you have to take it seriously. Chris Marniago, my homeboy, he believed in me before I believed in me, because I wasn't taught that I was supposed to believe in me. You know what I'm saying? And he was like, no, don't stop. Just keep doing the thing, and I'll keep helping you post, like, MySpace bulletins and stuff like that. A friend of mine, David Mant, who is younger than me, actually. And that was the thing that I was definitely really like a jerk about and being pretentious about, I think, was that you can't learn anything from anybody younger than you. What are you talking about? And he was a leader of an a cappella group I was in college. He was a president. And I was an upperclassman. He was a younger classman. He was just the way that he led and understood everybody in the group is 14 dudes. And everybody's emotional. Everybody's at the different times. Everybody's got finals. Everybody's like, blah, blah, blah. This a cappella thing is an extracurricular. But it's very important to us. And then just the way he understood everybody's personality and really tried to empathize and really tried to, like, lead at the group was like, wow, this is incredible. And it was also like, this dude's, like, 3 years younger than me, too.
Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing.
That's,
you know,
incredible.
And so that was a huge lesson, I think, in humility was like, oh, you can, like, learn something from everybody if you choose to see it that way or if you put yourself in the way to do that. Another thing, growing up, again, super homophobic in our, I was just raised that way. You know what I'm saying? We were just ready to be, you know, you got to be this hyper masculine type A, especially when you're like a young black man in America, especially because everybody thinks you're violent anyway, you know, growing up. So you learn to do those sorts of things. Your environment teaches you that you're supposed to be like that way. And to be gay was to be weak or to be wrong or whatever. And so I was exposed in that same group. I was exposed in close proximity because I had my gay friends back home. So also, you know, part of the church was like, that was the church that I ended up going to. It was like a big deal where there was like a gay person in the congregation. It was like excommunicated. It was a big ugly thing.
Oh, wow.
So getting to college and being in that a cappella group with like four or five gay dudes, I was just like, oh, these guys, you know what I'm saying? I just had these awful, these like terrible, ugly thoughts and like these assumptions about them. But then I realized like, I because just this just basing off the idea that like, if you're gay, you can't be a functioning member of society or a good person even, you know what I'm saying? And that was what I was taught.
Totally.
So meeting them and just realizing like, oh, like Dan is the guy that manages all of our finances. He like gets all of the travel, does all the logistics, and it's like perfect. Alex was the guy who would teach us all of our choreo and like create all the choreo and arrange some of the songs with David Mann and with Skipper Stradman, who was the guy who did all the music and choreo. And that was just that exposure again. That was a teaching moment to be able to teach me like, oh, all that stuff that I had learned about these people being bad people just because they like date other men or even are on the spectrum and like date women and date men or just fall in love with a person because that's what love is. And not their like genitalia or whatever. It was a process of unlearning that like, oh, these guys are just regular people and they just want to be loved. But they're also people who are contributing, functioning members of society, you know what I'm saying? And shouldn't be looked down upon and that kind of thing. Learning that with them, it helps you zoom out and
totally
like,
figure
learn
out
a
all
lot
the other
about,
stuff.
About and that's when you get into like intersectionality and like feminism and things like that.
And
oh,
it's
women
so
just want to be respected and
black
people just want to be respected and black lives do matter and like all you know, things like that.
Totally. It's so encouraging to kind of realize, hey, none of us are born woke and even the wokest people have to go through that journey to kind of unpack things. And you know, I think about the last, you know, few years or even the last, you know, 10 years of my life and think about all of the things that I have changed my opinion on, whether it's because I met someone who I, you know, I'd never met that kind of person before, or I heard a story or I, you know, I had an experience and all these things that just change. And when you're able to acknowledge, oh, this is something that changed in me, I was wrong. It just, it opens you up to be wrong in more and more places. But then when you do that, you realize like it opens you up to be more and more right or more and more accepting.
Or at least to discover more.
To discover more. Exactly. Yeah. There's so much more to discover. And
my friend Alex used to say, my fear decreases proportionate to the gaining of knowledge. That's something
ooh,
similar to
that. I like that.
Yeah. My fear of the unknown decreases in proportion to gaining more knowledge. Something to that effect. Sorry, Alex. I'm blowing it here. But but yeah, so I've been very, very lucky. I've had a lot of people to learn from and to watch them grow simultaneously along with myself. So yeah.
Man, that's beautiful.
Thank you.
What are
again,
the
oh my gosh, wow. He's so complimentary, this guy.
What are the things that that you're looking forward to right now? What are the things you're excited about?
Oh man, I'm excited about a lot. Writing a record, So I'm very pumped about that.
Good.
There's a lot of great music that's out now that I'm always excited about. We're playing a lot more shows later this year. Next biggest thing is Lollapalooza, which is another big fan. Right?
Lollapalooza.
I wish y'all
so cool.
Podcast land could have seen his face just then because he was like, yo.
I feel like that's the best festival because you don't have to camp. You can just stay in a hotel in Chicago.
Fam,
and
camping is garbage. Sorry. Not my vibe.
Or, no, I mean, you know, I'm down with camping. I don't want to camp in the middle of a party. You know what I mean?
Like, also fair. Yes,
I don't want to be surrounded by just like a rager.
With like 60,000 strangers.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm going to go camp where it's quiet. That's what camping is for.
I'm
going
to drive back to my house and take a shower and then come back again. But
that's great.
Yeah,
man.
Playing Lollapalooza. Very, very excited about that. And just releasing new music throughout the course of the year. Just working on it, trying to push forward and continue learning and growing and whatnot, you know?
Good. Do you feel like... You know, how long do you think you'll be R. Lamar versus Reggie versus another project?
Is it really a versus, though? You know?
No.
I don't think it's a versus. I feel, and at least in my perception of it, I mean, that's why they're all kind of also a subtle hint there is that they're all permutations of my name. It's like, they're all different aspects of me. Every person is like a multifaceted person. This podcast is not. You are a podcaster, you're a husband, you're a business owner. Everybody has all these different facets to themselves. And if you can honestly lean into creating something through that outlet, why stop it? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, I get that it's confusing as far as marketing and blah, 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 blah. But if people, who knows, you know what I'm saying? I put out a beat or something, just like a beat tape or something, and people react to that just as strongly as they do the Lamar stuff. Okay, cool. I'm producing now. Great. Or I just do that stuff for fun on my own, and which I do, and it leads into me producing more for my records or for whatever, or, you know, some of the acoustic guitar stuff that I was doing way, way, way then lends into me having skills, or at least like a beginning introductory ability with the electric guitar, which is what I use in my R. Lamar stuff. All these skills compound, you know what I'm saying? There's nothing I'm so passionate about. Like, we should be developing skills.
Yes.
And you should be developing skills and falling in love with the process of developing those skills. Because I think it's like, I think it's maybe not a missed opportunity. That's the wrong word I was thinking, but it's, I think the target is missed when you set your eyes on, like, you need to get to a certain point where you achieve a certain accolade or award or whatever, because that's the kind of stuff is like, okay, well, like, even if you get that, like, that thing that you're told is like the paramount, well, what do you do after that thing? You know, it was a hard lesson for me to learn that, like, once you get, like, for me, it's been like Rolling Stone. I've been featured in Rolling Stone a couple times. Again, not just toot my horn, but this is for an example.
No, it's huge.
And it is huge. It's a thing. It's a thing where, like, people of all generations, like my mother and my homeboy that writes with me, you know, people that aren't connected recognize that that's a context, like a context creating thing. That's a thing that's like, okay, this is legitimizing. But then you gotta not stop. Like, you gotta keep doing stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So once you get that accolade, cool. The credits don't roll. You don't just ride off into the sunset, you know what I'm saying? And everything happily ever after. You have to continue doing things. So I think focusing your energy and your ideas and your, like, effort and quality control, whatever that sense of it is for you, on the creation of the thing, whatever the thing is where your efforts will be well spent, I think. Because there will never not be another thing you can make, you know?
Yeah. Man, that's good. That's real
thanks.
Good. I like that.
Thanks. I'm just rambling. I'm just going. These are things I think about in my shower.
This is so good. Well, consider this a podcast shower.
Shower time. Shower time.
Shower
with
time
Reggie
with Brandon.
Brandon.
I'll let you do the theme songs and I'll
shower
just...
Shower time. Doo-doo-ba-ba-doo-ba-ba.
This is
somebody's gonna be listening to this and they're like morning commute and be like, what the hell am I listening to?
Yeah, they'll just like turn it on in the middle for some reason.
This? Yeah.
This has been such a good conversation. Indeed. Maybe I just kinda wanna wrap this up by, you know, you offering just a piece of advice for people who, you know, are hearing your story. They're inspired. They're encouraged. They want to take a step forward into, you know, not only creating something that they're proud of based off of their skills and abilities, but using that to kind of come full circle and give back to the people who gave back to them.
Yeah.
What's kind of a practical action step you would offer those people?
Oh, man, that is quite a question. I think, first off, try really hard to develop a sense of, like, empathy, I think. Just even outside of whatever you're creating or whatever your output is.
Yeah.
You know, whatever medium, it doesn't matter what creative medium it is, because you can be a mechanic as much as you can be a painter and still be in service. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because artists and creatives, and I consider anything where you have to make decisions is creative.
Period. Yeah.
In my, you know, you're pouring it really way down. So try to be empathetic in your decision making process. One. Two, don't lie. You know, there's no point. Because if you lie and you're successful with lie, you got to keep it up. And if you don't lie and people really connect to that, then cool. It's real. And that's a real thing. And that's a thing, something that so much of us are looking for, especially like in our 20s. It's just like something real, something we can like really feel and relate to. You know what I'm saying? And I feel like I had another little thing that I think about. Wow, this would be so hard. Whoever's listening to this, and if you have any like ideas or questions for me, tweet me. And I'll go down and I'll go through them, because this is like a really heady thing and a thing that I think about a lot. And it's like, it's one of those things where I'm like, do you ever get the thing when somebody's like, yo, what'd you do last weekend? And you're like, blank.
Oh,
I wasn't
up.
Dead. I know I did something. Like, I did something, but it's gone. But I think those two things are definitely things that I think about a lot.
Yeah.
But again, if anybody has any tidbits or want to ask me any specific questions, just tweet me in reference this podcast and tweet me.
Yeah. Anything else? If you don't mention my name in the tweet, he's not answering it.
He's fired. You're fired.
You're fired. Man, this has been good.
Yeah, this has
been
good.
I love that we dove straight into things.
Yeah.
And I love that we came full circle. We went all the way around. This is good.
Yeah, you guided it. You were guiding me. I appreciate it.
This is good. Producer all in, over all here. In the love shower.
It. Yeah. Oh, dear. You don't hear the... Okay, I'm done there.
What a great conversation. That was so fun. Isn't Reggie the best? I love what he said about music being a responsibility. He's modeled how to remain truthful to what you make, regardless of how light or dark it may be. And I deeply admire that kind of transparency and his sense of empathy and his focus on truth telling. We can all benefit from embodying that kind of honesty in our daily lives and the work that we do. And y'all, you have to check out his music. Go to wherever you listen to music and start with the song Frustrated. It's the single that currently has 37 million plays on Spotify alone. It's probably, you know, whatever the top track is. And from there, you'll be hooked. I guarantee it. He is such a beautiful artist, and he's doing something unique and beautiful. You can also check out his site, wearelamar.com. And for more thoughts and wisdom and photos and videos from R. Lamar, follow him on Twitter and Instagram at rlamarmusic. If you're new to Sounds Good, we would love for you to stick around. You'd also love my conversations with Joshua Dubois and Cubby Graham, both individuals who have found a way to use their skill sets and influence for good. You can find both of these episodes and more than 100 other episodes by searching for Sounds Good wherever you listen to podcasts. This podcast is created by me, Brandon Harvey, as a part of Good Good Good. We're a community that believes in the power of celebrating good news and becoming good news. Chad McElsnavely and the team at CM Studio edit and mix the show, and Christy Karenbrock offers her production support. You can get lots of hopeful stories on social media by following us everywhere at Good 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 CO. I personally recommend following us on Instagram because it's my favorite place. I don't actually do the posting on our account, and so I just get to refresh my Instagram feed and see the things that Good 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 is posting, and I really, really enjoy it. So follow us on Instagram, and also
Issue 5 of our Good News paper is just around the corner. My team and I are so excited about the upcoming release in late August. We'll keep you updated on Instagram and Twitter, so definitely keep your eye out for that. But in the meantime, we've made all of our back issues of the Good News paper available as a bundle for $20. So that's 4 of our past issues for $5 each. They come all shipped to you, and they're beautiful, you guys. They each come with a poster. They are gorgeous. People will ask you the story about them when they're sitting on your coffee table. You got to check them out. Shop the Good News paper and see what else we do at Good 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 at goodgoodgood.co. And on that note, that is a wrap for this week's episode. Go out and do some good this week. And let's keep telling the stories that bind us together. We need each other more than ever. Sound good?